Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this podcast and a wonderful Friday afternoon here in Chicago, Illinois. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Alexander Chimandy. He's the founder and the president of a company called Envescent. They are an award-winning industry-leading cybersecurity firm based in the Arlington, Virginia area, and it was founded in 1999. Alexander, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your time.
Absolutely, Robbie. Thanks for having me.
It's our honor and our privilege. Thank you. Now, we did some snooping on you. You know, we didn't do a background check or anything, but we looked up your bio, you know, on LinkedIn, Google, kind of did some search about your company, and you've got a wide range of skills, you know, broad technology skill set, cybersecurity. Now, I'm finding out you got a great skill set in finance. Just tell us about your background and tell us really more about your you know, the highlights of your career as it relates to cybersecurity, please.
Sure, and appreciate that glowing intro. So what I kind of started off way back before I was even a professional or even had considered anything involving technology was I was fortunate enough to receive a Commodore 64 128 when I was 5 years old, and it kind of got me set on this journey. I couldn't help myself but to try to learn more and more about it, so I was learning how to program. I was learning how to, you know, sort of take things apart and put them together on the hardware side and the software side, and once I got into that, I think within a couple of years, I kind of knew what destiny held for me. So when I was 15 years old, I got a job at a local internet provider, and I was doing tech support. And, you know, it's a good job for an entry-level kind of thing, and it got me kind of the ability to cut my teeth and figure out, you know, this wasn't exactly what I wanted to do, but it was the industry, just not the position. So I worked there for a little bit. I ended up leaving and actually taking a job in system and network administration at a nonprofit not too long after that. And that work was much more satisfying because it allowed me to challenge myself. I was working with new technology on a regular basis, and I really enjoyed it. And sadly, the nonprofit I was working for ran into some financial struggles, so they had to lay off about half the staff, and I was among them. But when that happened, it gave me an opportunity to sit back and say, okay, what do I want to do kind of for the next 3, 5, and 10 years? And so I sat back and I reflected, and, you know, my parents, my dad and my mom, self-employed. So, you know, I kind of thought, well, you know, even though they're in a different field, they probably have some pointers. Maybe they could give me some direction. So I said, I'm going to take that idea of being self-employed, but I'm going to apply it to technology. So I became a freelance consultant. I helped businesses with their websites, with their security, with their IT, and kind of started to build Envescent out starting in 1999. So we're now a 21-year-old company. A lot of time has passed, and some of the things that that we've done are, you know, work with Fortune 1000 companies to help them with incident response, to help them with locking down the kind of vulnerable attack surface that they might have. But we also really focus on working with companies that have maybe 100 or less people and need a more hands-on approach to cybersecurity. We were fortunate enough to receive the Arlington Chamber of Commerce Best Technology Small Business Award in 2018, and there was some pretty decent competition there, so I was actually really surprised at the award ceremony that they called us, and quite honored, of course. And so for us, it's been a pretty good run so far. You know, obviously, the cybersecurity industry is growing now at a point where it's something that, you know, A, businesses are seeing as much more of an important part of their overall technology spend. But B, you know, back in 1999, people were like, why does security matter unless I've been hacked? And now, you know, even though the ship hasn't completely 180'd, we're starting to see a different point of view.
Okay, excellent. Now, what led you to the founding of Envescent in 1999? Were there other reasons, other factors perhaps, other than, you know, wanting to fulfill that technology need and entrepreneurial niche that you had? Were there any other
Absolutely.
Dynamics?
That's a good question, Ravi. So one of the things that got me really interested in trying to go out on my own was I had, you know, back then we were kind of in the go-go or late stage of the dot-com bubble. So there was all this hype about, you know, hey, just start a company, have a dot-com, you're automatically going to be a millionaire. And while I didn't buy into that much of it, I did see one major trend shifting. I saw that people were embracing technology more readily. and that technology was going to be a major part of the future of business. And so that was one of the areas where I said, you know, I could work for someone else, and it probably wouldn't be bad, but I've had two kind of mediocre experiences working with other organizations. Let me just try going out on my own and sort of trying to ride this new wave of technology into the future and see how many people I could help. One of the biggest things that got me wanting to be in technology was helping people, and I felt like the best way I could do that was to have my own business.
Okay, excellent. Now, how has cybersecurity changed between 1999 and now? In fact, well, that's a great question. I never really even asked my previous guest about that. I'll kind of elaborate a little bit more on that. I just finished grad school. I just finished my master's in economics back like in 93, and I think right when I was doing my MBA in information systems, that's when the dot-com craze was really starting to take off. And I remember the big slogan from Sun Microsystems, we're the dot and dot-com. I don't think anybody really understood cybersecurity. I don't think that word was available or even came out. I know for sure I didn't even hear that word back then. I mean, security was an issue. Security was the main buzzword, but nobody really thought of cybersecurity, and I think the first cyber attack maybe that I know of happened to AOL, I think, in 1999. That's like the first documented phishing attack. So share your insight on that, Alexander. How has that landscape changed from back then to now?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that is a great question, and it really has. There's quite a contrast. The one thing on the human side, and I alluded to this a little bit earlier, but I want to expound upon it, is that you know, back then, the level of awareness that security was even something to be concerned about was very low. So, you know, it was more of, oh, we see that we've been hacked, so we should act on that. And most of the time preceding that sort of an event, there was a lot of apathy or even just total unawareness of it being something important. Another thing that changed a lot in the last two-plus decades is that, you know, back then, and I'm not saying it was all of it, there was certainly organized crime and governments involved, but it wasn't nearly to the extent that it is now. Back then, it was a lot more curious kids in their mom's basements plugging away on computers, just trying to figure out how these things work. There was more sort of, I won't call it pure innocence, but there was more hacking without a profit malicious motive going on. And so the threat landscape was a little more benign, not, you know, certainly not without a lot of potential for problems, but it wasn't like we see today. And one of the things that I really remember, and I think it was back in 2002, 2003, somewhere around there, maybe a little earlier, but there was the SQL Slammer. And when that got out there targeting those Microsoft SQL servers that were internet exposed, which, you know, as we know, should never really be internet exposed without a good firewall, maybe a VPN or encrypted tunnel, but nonetheless they were, it pretty much took down chunks of the internet. And I remember it really well because it impacted me. We were on Sprint connectivity, and, you know, back then we're on like a T1, which, you know, at the time seemed pretty fancy, but now it's like you got a gig pipe to your place, so it's almost like 70 T1s put together. But or 700 actually. But back then, what we saw was that SQL Slammer was spreading at such a fast rate, it was flooding entire network providers and endpoints off the internet. And so I had reached out to Sprint. I knew they were running Cisco routers, and I said, "Hey, drop this rule set in. See if it helps. It should block that traffic, which you shouldn't even really have going over your network at all." And they started to apply it to some of the routers here and there, and eventually the problem cleared up on their network, and they were one of the earlier ones to be able to block a lot of that traffic out. I remember it was taking down airports, banks, whole websites, so it was going beyond just the network side, and there was just so much vulnerable attack surface, because back in 1999 and all the way up to, say, 2006 or 7, there wasn't really a lot of thought about firewall and mitigating attack surface and using encrypted endpoints and having an extra authentication layer. A lot of stuff was just kind of left out in the open. Now you fast forward to today, and while we still see wide-scale, you know, attacks, there's a lot more usually done by default, at the provider side, by application developers, by network equipment, especially if you get like a commercial-grade firewall, to provide mitigation so that that sort of problem isn't going to be as widespread. And you even see, like, if you're a network service provider, there's going to be more capability for you to mitigate that kind of attack in real time and even monitor your network to see it in its early stages and start to clamp it down. Another thing that we saw that really has changed between then and now are the attitudes towards cybersecurity. While I won't say that they're as good as they should be, I think there's room for improvement. There's certainly more desire for companies to say, hey, I should probably look at this and do something about it before it becomes a problem, rather than waiting for it to become a problem. And one of the things we like to drive home is it's always cheaper to be preventive than to be reactive. And that message was not well heard in 1999 and really up to like the mid-2000s, but we started to see some more resonance with it as these attacks and their reputational, financial, and legal impacts started to really scale. And as I talked about just a little bit earlier, the actors behind the attacks started to shift as well. So we went from, hey, you know, it's some kids in their mom's basement for some of these things, and, you know, while there was some organized crime and governments involved, now most of the attacks are coming from organized crime and government. And so the threat paradigm, both in terms of the sophistication of the threats, the people behind it, but also the response capabilities, have all changed quite a bit since 1999. And the good news is that because more companies are paying attention, there's a lot that can be done to try to remediate this impact before it happens, and more companies seem amiable to do that. But the bad news is I would still say that we probably have, especially in the small and medium-sized business contingent, a lot more room to go before I could say I'm comfortable with the amount of attention that's paid to cybersecurity.
Okay, excellent. Well, now, who is your typical client base, or who do you serve? I mean, you can tell us on a general level. Are they mostly in the D.C., Virginia area, or do you go help clients beyond that region? Or, for example, is most of your work can be done remotely, or is it more like on-site assessments or on-site meetings? Can you tell us more about that?
Absolutely, yeah, and that's such a good question, given that we're in this sort of era of self-imposed isolation. So remote work has become the sort of go-to, and we're fortunate enough to be in a position where the majority of our work we can execute it remotely, and we can do a great job for our clients and kind of make sure that we're able to do almost everything we can do in person, other than physical hardware swaps. In terms of who we serve, we largely are focused on businesses that don't have in-house cyber. So we're looking at businesses that are usually 100 employees or less, you know, ideally in industries where they're either regulated or handling sensitive data, so there's some sort of motivation to pay attention to cybersecurity. But that being said, we do serve Fortune 1000 companies. You know, a lot of the time they're going to need a third party, an independent set of eyes to come in, check on their network, check on their systems, check on their people, their physical office-based security, and kind of make sure that everything is secure, and if it's not, remediate that sort of vulnerable attack surface. And in terms of our regionality, we started off primarily serving the DC area, but what we found, even, you know, back in like the early 2000s, was once you have a website up, you start to get leads from everywhere. So we've had clients, you know, in Canada, we've had clients in Israel, we've had clients in various countries of Africa, we've had clients pretty much all over the world, but the majority of them are within the D.C. area and within the United States.
Oh, wow, okay. Now, who is your typical customer base? Is it the SMB, small, medium-sized business market, or is it the Fortune 500, or perhaps a mixed match of both?
We're targeting a lot of the smaller companies that have compliance requirements or are receiving engagement letters or are otherwise proactive about cybersecurity. And I really feel like that's the area that needs the help the most. Sometimes they're a little less receptive because it's more sensitive of a budget item. But I feel like if we're going to have the biggest impact as we can to help as many people as we can and try to reduce the disruptions to business continuity or even existence itself, it's going to be in that sort of 100 or less segment. But that being said, we really do like serving the larger companies too, because quite often is the case, and I see this almost on a daily basis now, is that something important hasn't been addressed. So, you know, you kind of look at how their email is set up, and maybe they're blasting emails out and they don't have a proper DMARC in place. And so when they're sending out an email, a third party could also send out an email from their domain, and chances are it's going to get to the recipient and they can engage in a successful phishing attack. And DMARC has been around for a long time, and the U.S. government actually even almost said, this is a requirement, but they backed off of it because not enough had adhered to it. Sort of like that transition to IP version 6. You know, they keep saying, hey, we're going to go to IP version 6, and every year we don't because not enough have done it. But DMARC is much more important because it's a framework that helps companies to ensure that when they're sending an email, you know, they're using SPF, they're using DKIM, so they have some kind of verification for the authenticity of the sender or the mail transfer agent. And they also have DMARC to define how emails that don't fit that authentication framework, that don't qualify for it, how they're handled. So you can quarantine them, you can dump them, you can just monitor it. And I'll tell you, and I know it's a little bit of a segue, but DMARC is so important because phishing attacks are on the rise. And if all these companies were using DMARC as a part of their email framework, chances are that a lot of these damaging phishing attacks, at least from the outbound side, would be mitigated. So we try to help with projects like that for companies large and small, but our ideal client base is usually the smaller companies. You know, for the larger companies, you might go in there for a project or for periodic review. For the smaller companies, we're really acting as a virtual CISO or Chief Information Security Officer, where we kind of are handed the reins for all things cybersecurity and the responsibilities that come therewith and helping them execute those on a daily basis.
Okay, excellent. Now, let's get your product and service line. I mean, it looks like you've got a lot of, you know, different unique product offerings or service offerings, and security policy creation, vulnerability management, compliance, training, you know, incident response, research and intelligence consulting, and a lot of other areas too. In fact, you mentioned the VC. So can you elaborate more on those in a little bit more detail? And what are your main, you know, focuses on these areas as it relates to cybersecurity? But one thing I wanted to bring about, Alexander, is that I think the planning, the security planning, I was at your website, but it was before we got on air, and I know that you help people, like, with security policy formulation and so forth. I think apart from all these other things we hear about, the Zoom bombing, you know, and working from home issues, blah, 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 I think businesses are now starting to realize the importance of a incident response plan and a business continuity plan. You know, in case something, hopefully nothing like this will ever happen in our lifetimes or ever. But if it does, I think businesses are now starting to realize, ooh, we got to have something in place so we can mobilize our workforce quickly and our business operations quickly without any downtime. So can you elaborate, once you expand a little bit more on these services, can you spend a little bit more time on the security area? And I think we got some more questions on that, but I just kind of want to give that as a segue.
I love that, and I'm going to start there because it actually really fits in nicely with the first area that you mentioned, which is policy creation and management. So my philosophy on cybersecurity and really IT in general is it all starts with a baseline of a good policy, and it has to be a policy that matches what the expectations of the company are, of its employees, of its IT resources, of any kind of regulatory oversight and compliance it might have, of the engagement letters it receives from its clients. And that's a policy that needs to be updated regularly because technology is fluid. It's changing. The ways that the company might be offering services or engaging clients is changing, and the threats that are out there that the company is facing are also changing. So policy is something that we help all of our clients with when they're receptive to it and they need that kind of help. And I feel like, you know, everything else gets built on top of that. And inside that policy, you're going to have, you know, a subset of policies either in a single document or broken out into multiple documents. And among them are going to be things like an incident response plan and a business continuity plan. And it's great that you mentioned that because I will say that in policy and also just, you know, as a segue into legal discussion in business contracts, there's really no mention of events like this. You know, that we have things like in contracts, we have things like force majeure. In policies, we have things like business interruption. But a lot of the time, it doesn't define a period of having to work remotely for an extended period of time. And almost nowhere that I've seen does it define anything like a pandemic and what the implications of that are for the business, for its continuity, for its employees, its IT resources. So I feel like when COVID-19 happened, the majority of businesses were struggling to kind of figure out, okay, how do we do this? You know, how do we adapt and shift gears to have our employees work remotely, if that's even possible for their business model? Now, thankfully, in the professional services area, which is one of our core focuses, a lot more businesses are able to work remotely. They're able to kind of prosecute their tasks as a disparate team as long as they can collaborate with cloud-based resources. But they still don't necessarily have a plan in place. And they still, in most situations, don't have a business continuity plan that is up to date to define the kind of risks we face in today's environment. So I think a business continuity plan is really important. There's great templates out there that businesses can look at as a resource to say, hey, if X happens, Y is how we respond. And every business continuity plan at this point needs to have a variable that's defined for pandemic. You know, sad as it is to say, and I hope I'm incorrect about this, but these sorts of pandemics are probably not going to be a stranger to us simply because, you know, our ability to research and treat and cure viruses on a biological side is much less far along than it is for the more simple synthetic viruses we see on the digital side. And that, you know, hopefully that research starts to really expand and we get more robust at being able to address these things. But for the time being, we need to kind of assume when we're building these business continuity plans, you know, that the worst could happen and it could happen repeatedly. And we needed to just sort of document that. And also train on every time a policy document is written of any kind, employees should be trained on it. If contractors are deeply involved with day-to-day operations, they should be trained on it as well. And often is the case that when you're in a regulated industry or when you're in the receipt of engagement letters, training is an expectation that the client wants to have happen. In terms of incident response plans, that's definitely incredibly important and probably even more important now in the sense that if we look at the pre-COVID era, and then we start to look at where we are now, and now we're the 1st of May, but I've got data just kind of going through to late April. Security incidents and attack attempts are up about 667% from when we were kind of in a more normal environment to where we are in this pandemic environment. There's a lot of opportunism. So you've got malicious hackers that are looking for a way to get into that remote workforce's computer. They're on a home network. They've got a home router. Sometimes they've got their home computer. So all the sort of resources they had on that corporate side, the corporate firewall, intrusion prevention, monitoring, maybe that endpoint protection, Active Directory and group policies, all that is typically not in place if they're working from home. And that's a big problem. So that means that not only are incidents more likely to happen because everything's more permeable, but it also means that it's less likely that IT is going to know an incident is happening because there's less visibility of those assets. So having an incident response plan, it's really important because I think a lot of the companies that are kind of going through this right now have sort of been flying by the seat of their pants, hoping for the best, but not necessarily planning for the worst. And that business continuity plan and that incident response plan are core components of a policy to do just that. And if it's written down and it's, you know, maintained and the team is trained on it, then the chances are that when something like this happens, it's more like, oh, well, we've done a fire drill on this before. We as unfortunate as it is, we know how to respond and we're well positioned to respond. So I feel like that those are core components of policy creation and management. I appreciate you bringing those up. And the rest of the policy is similar. Like, how are employees handling data? Is that information compartmentalized or does everyone have access to everything? What are the expectations of an employee if they are in receipt of a suspicious message or suspect their computer has been compromised? If those sorts of questions haven't been articulated in a policy and employees aren't aware of what their responses should be, then they kind of go into either a panic mode or just, hey, I'm going to ignore it until something bad happens. And we don't want either one of those scenarios. We want a well-defined plan and we want folks to be trained on it so that they know what to do in that situation. And vulnerability management comes right into play as well. It should be part of a policy because really you want to have some kind of routine frequency that a third party is coming in and kind of opening up the network, the systems, talking to people, looking at the physical office, you know, having a sense of what the attack surface is, where it's vulnerable, where there's the most risk, and coming up with a remediation strategy once that's been quantified to say, hey, we noticed that, you know, you're forwarding your remote desktop to the internet. And that's a big attack surface. You probably shouldn't be doing that because it's much easier for a hacker to exploit RDP if it's not patched, or it might be easier for them to brute force a password or otherwise get into your internal network. Now, if you put that behind a VPN with strong authentication and encryption, you've mitigated that risk and you've also closed out that internal attack surface, and you have a lot more control over what assets those parties might have access to once they authenticate over the VPN. So there's good ways to do these things, and if we go through a vulnerability management process, we can quantify what the risk is, and then we can sit down with the client and say, these are the biggest risks you should be paying attention to based on our analysis. You know, we can help you address those risks, or we can at least show you how to address those risks. And then what we recommend after the remediation phase is to come back again and do another assessment and say, okay, well, we know where we should be. Where actually are we in this process? How much of sort of the vulnerable attack surface has been battened down? So that if there is an attack, if there is a storm, you know, how bad are things going to necessarily look? And while we can't be fully cognizant of every vulnerability, because there's ones that haven't been disclosed to the public, there's ones that, you know, are zero day, if we're adhering to best practices, chances are we're going to reduce the amount of attacks that can happen by about 80%. And that's a nice segue into compliance, because when we look at compliance, a lot of the compliance is commonsensical. So if you look at the NIST frameworks, the ISO frameworks, the DoD expectations of security from their vendors, and other similar things, SEC cybersecurity recommendations, they all kind of come along the same basic recommendations. And that is to say, make sure that you're taking security seriously, that you're having a policy, that you're training on it, that you're doing vulnerability management, that you have good endpoint protection, a good firewall, that you have processes in place that if something happens, you know how to respond to it. So if there's a breach, you're sending out breach notification letters, you're providing maybe identity theft protection or something else to the clients to try to mitigate risk. Here in Virginia, speaking of compliance, and this is the sort of thing that a lot of folks aren't aware of, you know, you might not be in a regulated industry, but if you handle any sensitive data, PII, PHI, any kind of information like that, then you're going to find yourself on the wrong side of a potentially large civil fine and other measures of liability if you have a large enough breach. So in Virginia, there can be up to a $150,000 fine per incident where more than 1,000 records are compromised. So, you know, you might not be in a regulated industry, but there's still compliance you have to adhere to. And our state is not unique in that. A lot of other states have similar frameworks in place where the attorney general can level civil penalties against your organization if they're mishandling customer data and not notifying them when that data gets breached. So that's an area we pay a lot of attention to. We're in the DC area, so as you can imagine, we've got a lot more customers that need help with compliance because there's more interfacing with the federal government. And to the credit of the federal government and of late state and local governments, they are taking compliance much more seriously. You know, you look at 5-10 years ago, or you go back to 1999 when we first started, and, you know, it was more of a suggestion. Like, you guys really should be doing this, but if you're small enough, you know, we'll put the kitty gloves on. We understand. We're not going to be too stringent about it. These days, that's completely changed. If you're not adhering to those requirements, in a lot of situations, you're not going to get the contract. You might not even be able to get to bid on it. So it's a really important area to pay attention to. But, you know, you look at the ESO 27001 framework, and even if you're not in a regulated industry, that's a great baseline to look at to say, these are the basic building blocks of good cybersecurity. It can be built into policy. It can be built into practices. And that's a good segue into training. Because training, I feel like, once you have a good policy, is one of the most important elements, because 50% of the breaches happen with that human element. If employees and contractors aren't aware of what the expectations are of how they handle data, of how they handle their systems, like, you know, are they leaving their laptop unsecured, how they are supposed to be dealing with a suspicious message or a malware infection, you know, what the awareness level they might have of the latest threats are, if they don't have that information in mind and it's not refreshed regularly, and we recommend about a year, every year or so, you know, coming back and doing training to refresh, then a lot of the time when something happens, it's going to be worse than it should be. Because if they had that information in hand, you know, when something suspicious was seen, they would have reported it, they would have been able to take action, and the issue would have been able to be clamped down a lot earlier. And it's especially important now because a lot of people are working from home and they're sort of isolated from that, you know, someone kind of peering over their shoulder and making sure everything is going okay, and the sort of monitoring and protection that comes therewith. So if ever there was a time to really make sure that, you know, a company has a robust training regimen in place, it's now. And it's more important than it's ever been before, but it's always been important. And it kind of segues a little bit into incident response, because if you have good training, then an employee can alert IT and the executive team that, hey, we suspect there's been an incident. And the sooner that you can respond to something that's suspicious, the better the outcome is going to be. Now, obviously, you don't want to have an incident if you can avoid it, and some of the things we've just talked about can try to mitigate that risk. But sadly, the threat landscape is evolving so rapidly, the attacks are becoming so sophisticated, that chances are every business is going to have an incident at some point. You know, we can reduce the risk, but we can't take it away completely. So having that incident response capability, and that's an area that we work in pretty regularly. And a lot of the time we're going in and we're trying to make sure that an attack that's happened, that we can quantify how it happened, where it came from, what may have been impacted, and what we can do to reduce the chances of that happening again. Sometimes we're also doing digital forensics to get a sense of, you know, who the actors were behind that in enough granularity that it can be taken to a criminal or at least civil level where there might be a prosecution or litigation. And then in other situations in incident response, we're also trying to get a sense of, why did this internal information get out of the company? Was it an insider breach? Which insider did it? Was it a former employee that left because they were fired, or maybe they were disgruntled and they quit and they took internal information with them? And, you know, as sad as it is to say, we would hope that's not very common, but it is. It's much more common than one would think. And having some of these monitoring controls in place can make it much easier to identify that. But chances are, if we're coming in for an incident response for something like that, those controls might not be in place, and that might be one of the reasons an incident happened. So just as an example of one of these types of incidents we've seen, we were working for a firm. We were brought in as sort of just a firefighter, in the sense that they kind of would use us when they needed us, but they wouldn't necessarily adhere to or be receptive to proactive advice. So, you know, we'd help them build out some security measures, and then it'd be kind of, you know, crickets for a while until something happened that they needed help with. And so we had one of those types of calls when an employee was fired because they were allegedly not doing a good job. And, of course, we can't judge that because we're not supervising the employee, but that's what we were told. And they said they suspected that the employee was exfiltrating internal trade secrets to a third party who ended up being the new employer of said employee. So, or ex-employee, I guess you could say. So we did our forensics. We actually grabbed their former computer. We imaged the hard drive, and we put it into a read-only environment and started to take a look at everything in there. And we were able to find that there was ample evidence that they were using a third-party storage service, in this case Dropbox, and they were uploading internal company data to that and sending it over to another person at this company that they ended up being employed at. Now, obviously, there's a lot of legal implications for this. It's something that's heavily frowned upon. It's also illegal. There's financial liabilities for the damages that could have been done to the company. So it was a big deal. It was a big mess. But at the same time, being able to identify that risk, understand what happened, and try to get ahead of it is much better than just trying to ignore it and hope it goes away. Because if other employees are able to glean that, hey, you know, let's say this guy's name was Fred Smith. When Fred was fired and he took all that data with him and he monetized it and he got a better job because of it, it seems like nothing happened. I could do that too and get away with it. So if you show that there's some response measures in place, and you know, they began to become more receptive, this client of ours, to doing more proactive monitoring and network security, and most importantly, compartmentalization of data, because if that had happened, this wouldn't have been possible in the first place. Then, you know, we started to be able to at least help them mitigate the chance of future incidents. I feel like just as an aside, that a lot of the incidents that we see, and studies show this, like the Verizon Internet Security Report that comes out every year, confirm this, that, you know, about 80% or 4 out of 5 incidents can be mitigated with best practices. And that's an enormous amount of risk just kind of taken off the table by investing in cybersecurity and seeing it as something that can kind of pay forward by mitigating those risks and by keeping the company safer. So another area with that in mind that we work on is research and intelligence. So, you know, a lot of the threats that come out are known. but there's still a contingent that are not known. So with the ones that are known, you know, often is the case, the vendors put out a patch, and when they put out the patch, they kind of spell out what's wrong. You know, they might say, oh, well, this service has this vulnerability, and so we're patching it to address that vulnerability. It doesn't exactly say how do you weaponize it, but it gives malicious hackers enough of a clue to maybe start experimenting in their own lab and trying to figure out how can I use that vulnerability as a method to get in. And then they can start building exploits and testing them, and if they, those exploits work, all those unpatched systems, of which there are many, can be attacked with that vulnerability. You know, they can be, that exploit can be used. But there's also a lot of undocumented vulnerabilities being exploited in the wild, especially of late. And so it's helpful to have sort of cutting-edge research and intelligence, both for us so that we can help protect our clients better, and for our clients so that if they are a little more savvy about the sort of risks and they want to try to get ahead of those risks, they can take measures internally to do that as well. So we set up various honeypots. We monitor malicious attacks. We take those payloads from exploits that are being directed at public-facing internet addresses, and basically we mimic a vulnerable server. Windows server, Linux server, you know, other kinds of systems like network appliance firmware. We try to put that out there so that basically when a payload is injected, we can take it, we can reverse engineer it, we can start to figure out, hey, is this new and unique? Do we need to pay extra attention to it? Is this a zero-day vulnerability? Or is this something that's already known and we can kind of put it off to the side, maybe take a closer look at it if you know, if it's warranted, if it's severe enough or interesting enough. But by having that information about zero-day vulnerabilities, we can help vendors provide them a heads up before we do any kind of public disclosure. And we can also help clients because we can say, hey, you know, we've come into information that leads us to believe that X and Y need to be either shut down, or we need to change the configuration, or we need to otherwise try to protect those assets because we have reason to believe that they may be vulnerable to attack. So having that research and intelligence is a big asset for us. It's a big asset for our clients. And it's an area that's also, it's quite a bit of fun. If you're really kind of a geek on security, knowing what the bad guys are up to, you know, kind of on a moment-by-moment basis is really helpful and really fascinating. And it also helps with our consulting. So we work on helping clients kind of get into shifting gears into best practices. A lot of businesses are in more of a reactive posture, especially smaller businesses, because they just don't have the wherewithal, they don't have the budget, they don't have the awareness. But we try to bridge that gap. So we try to come in, and if we're not filling the role of like a CISO, we're at least coming in and saying, you know, well, if you did this and that, you know, you'd probably mitigate your risk quite a bit. If you took this measure more seriously, you'd probably be able to deflect a lot of the types of attacks that could get you. And one example that we always try to hammer home is two-factor authentication. So Microsoft put out a research study, and they said on our Office 365 and other Microsoft accounts, or I guess it's called Microsoft 365 now, we've noticed that if you have two-factor authentication, the risk of an account breach is down 99.9%. So that basically means only 1 out of 1,000 breach attempts on these accounts are successful, which is such a significant risk. And while two-factor authentication might be a little inconvenient to set up, and you know, I know people don't want to enter passwords, let alone a code after a password, just because it adds a little bit more overhead, the other side of it is the risk that you're mitigating is so enormous that it's worth it. It's worth every penny of what it costs to set it up, monitor it, and just sort of make sure that everyone's using it. And if it's not going to be used across the board, at least everyone that handles anything remotely sensitive and anyone with privileged administrative features should have that two-factor authentication.
Okay, excellent. Now, this actually kind of leads me to a series of other questions. Now, in terms of compliance, has he done any work with GDPR, the CCPA, or even for that matter, the CMMC certification that's coming up here soon?
Yes. So GDPR is active, and while enforcement has been mostly against larger companies, they're starting to ramp it. And I believe that they've kind of eased off a little bit with what's happening with COVID-19 because, you know, everyone's aware that we can't really act as rapidly as we'd like to on things like this. But GDPR has been a game changer because, again, if you have an internet website, you're on the internet, you're facing the whole world. And now you have a region where you have to handle their data differently than other regions. So that creates a bit of a conundrum. do we, A, treat all European traffic and people with a different set of rules, or do we, B, adapt that set of rules globally? And when we see CCPA coming online, and it's somewhat similar in terms of the amount of privacy and security that's expected of private information, it pushes us more towards we should maybe look at making these rules globally. So what we see with GDPR a lot of the times, especially in larger companies that have a large presence in Europe, is, you know, we kind of need to either put them into their own box and have a separate framework for every European IP address and every user that identifies from being within the EU and how their data is compartmentalized and handled and how requests for that data by third parties are handled. And then we also see with CCPA, it was supposed to come online, I want to say, in June or July, but they keep kind of pushing it forward because of COVID-19. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense because really you don't want to roll out a new privacy framework when people are just paying attention to can we stay in business. But eventually that's going to come online too. And that's a game changer. And I have some thoughts about it. On the one hand, I applaud the state of California for being on the forefront of this, as our federal government has kind of dragged its feet on this issue for a long time. We've needed privacy regulation in the United States. Our country's set of laws is a lot different than the EU in the sense that if I'm doing business with you, you own the data that I give you. If you're in the EU and I'm in the EU, then it's the opposite. I actually own my data, and I'm kind of giving you the benefit of that data, but I can request it back. I can request you to delete it. We don't really have that in the U.S., so it's a different paradigm. California is starting to shift that in the other direction, and that's the good news. The bad news is there's other states that are looking at doing similar. I think Massachusetts, Nevada, and New York are kind of looking at their own frameworks, but we have 50 states in the United States, and we have various territories too. The patchwork and the risk of having a sort of discombobulated regulatory framework for privacy on a state-by-state basis is really difficult, because if you have a small business or even a larger business and each state has different requirements and you need to quantify where traffic's coming from, where people might be located, and how you handle them differently than another state, I mean, that basically puts the onus on the business as to, okay, well, now I need to pay extra careful attention to how we analyze our website, how we deal with customers from California versus customers from Virginia, you know, how we deal with requests, because each state's requests for private information are going to be a little bit different. So I love that California is taking the initiative, but from there, what I'd really like to see is the federal government put together a cohesive framework for the entire United States that kind of supersedes what the states are doing and is possibly a little more stringent as well, so that we don't have to deal with the possibility of a patchwork. Because it's really a nightmare scenario for IT and security and the sort of chief privacy and security officers at any company to deal with that being so fragmented and so sort of disparate on a state-by-state basis. And it goes back to the whole thing of, you know, as soon as you put a website online, you're on the internet, you're available globally, and whether you know it or not, you're subject to every one of these regulations when they go live.
Okay, excellent. Now, you had mentioned two-factor authentication, and, you know, my background has been biometrics when I first got started in security. Have you done any work with biometric technology for 2FA? I know that, like, it's on, like, the iPhone, and you get the, you know, Face ID, Touch ID, but now facial recognition is starting to really pick up here with the COVID ID. Have you done any work with that when implementing 2FA?
Yes and no. So it much more common in larger organizations. It's less common in the smaller companies that we tend to work with. I do have some concerns about the sophistication of biometrics, at least as they're concerned with things like phones and the fingerprint readers that they have on them, as well as the fingerprint readers on laptops. They don't seem to recognize enough points on the fingerprint to be able to reliably discern that it's this person's fingerprint rather than a crude copy of it. You know, you can actually scrape the surface of that. You can 3D print something that is a replicate of that's close enough for these sensors, and then put it on your finger, and the heat behind your finger allows it to authenticate with that fake fingerprint as the other person's fingerprint. And, you know, the sort of grease that's left behind on that sensor is just enough to be able to get a sense as to what that pattern is. And because these are looking at 3 to 5 points on a fingerprint, it's easier to fool them. Now, that's not to say that that's a common thing. I mean, you're talking about a sophisticated attacker with local access to a device to be able to pull that off. But if you're in an organization that's looking at biometrics, you're probably already at a point where you're facing that kind of sophisticated attacker, at least for some of the more sensitive data that might be held within. So on the one hand, I like where it's going. On the other hand, I think there's a lot of room for improvement on some areas of biometrics. You mentioned Face ID, and that's been interesting because, you know, we had the Apple Face ID, and it was pretty cool because you could just look at your phone, and then your phone would open up. But now everyone's wearing masks, and so that same identification system isn't working. And I know that they're going to work on patching it. They've talked about, you know, kind of focusing more on the eyes and the bridge of the nose and looking at those areas to identify you and make sure that it's unique enough. But without that much area of the face, it's also going to be easier to spoof that type of authentication. So on the one hand, I think that there's a big future with biometrics. I think once we get more savvy about using them, it will be a more robust way to do multi-factor authentication. But I think at present, for some of the sort of entry-level and mid-grade biometrics, we're not quite there yet if you're facing a sophisticated adversary.
Yeah, it's a good point about the face mask. I didn't even really think about that, actually. So now let's get into another important piece of cyber, and I'll kind of lump these next few questions all into, like, one big question here. Okay, we've talked about, like, IR planning, DR planning, and, you know, BC planning, but the crux of all these plans comes from a basic security policy of a company. So how do you let me put it this way. Obviously, it's the foundation for cybersecurity, right? So how do you help clients develop a security policy for the first time? What steps should they consider taking? How should they know it's being enforced? And three, how do you provide the training for the employees to be cognizant of, hey, this is my company's security policy and how do I maintain a good cyber hygiene?
That's a great question. And basically, it's something that we have to be very considerate of on a case-by-case basis. We don't believe in cookie-cutter approaches, and it's really important because each business is different, each industry is different, the types of data they handle are different, so the approach that we have to take varies. Now, often is the case that we'll come in, and there will either be no policy at all or an outdated or ineffective policy. So the first thing we try to do is get a sense of what do you already have, how are you working with it, are people being trained, is that defining how you're working with your IT assets? And then we also try to get a sense of, okay, are you regulated? And we don't just mean, you know, from the major regulation that everyone is aware of, but what about the state-level regulation? Do you sign engagement letters? Are you adhering to what's being requested of you? Are you transparent with those clients that you might not be able to do so? Then we start to get a sense of, you know, kind of where they are, and we can better advise them. Now, for smaller clients that don't have a robust cybersecurity budget, there are templates out there that are useful. SANS has a good amount of those templates available on their website where you can download them, pop them into a Word document, and kind of start to tweak them for what makes sense for your company. So for smaller clients, we kind of recommend starting there and then, you know, send it over for our review. We can make edits. We can show them what we're editing and why. And then they can start to effectuate that policy, and we can begin to work with them on it. For larger clients, if they have an existing policy in place, which is generally the case, it's usually either a little out of date or it's not fully applicable to how they're doing things. And what I mean by that, and the latter is actually an issue for companies large and small, is you might have a policy, but it might be either too stringent, that is to say you're just not adhering to it, and you're not going to adhere to it, even if you're aware of it, you're not going to take those steps. That can actually create more liability, because if you're saying you're doing things you're not doing, and you get hacked, and they say, okay, well, let's look at your policy. Oh, were you doing this and this and this? Oh, you weren't? Well, maybe your cybersecurity insurance coverage isn't going to cover you, or maybe you're going to be more liable on a civil basis, or maybe other kinds of concerns like that are going to come up. So the other thing is we want to make sure that whatever we craft or help our clients craft is not only strong enough to protect them and try to mitigate risk, but also that it's flexible enough that they're actually adhering to it on a day-to-day basis. In terms of training, there's a couple of approaches that we take to try to do the best job possible for our clients on training. One of which is, you know, outside of helping them craft a policy that's applicable to their organization and how they actually operate and sort of what the expectations of them are externally, we also like to get a sense of what are the knowledge gaps of employees. So in ideal scenarios where we're afforded the budget to do so, we'll do things like phishing tests. So we'll go in and we'll pretend, you know, hey, look, it's Microsoft 365. Your password is expired. You better hit this link and enter your username and password that was there before so you can reset to a new one. Or, hey, it's LinkedIn. You've got a new message. You know, you should download this message and log into our website or, you know, anything like that. And we try to be as specific as we can to craft those messages to appear that they're coming from organizations the company's regularly working with or parties that they're regularly working with, because that's what real phishing attacks look like. And so we could do a better job for our client identifying those weaknesses by emulating what the bad actors are doing and then providing the client's feedback about that. We also like to do interviews and just kind of sit down or at least have a form that people fill out and get a sense as to, you know, where their strengths are and where their weaknesses are. And from a composite data analysis of that information, we can say, oh, well, it looks like, you know, employees don't have a lot of awareness of ransomware or something like that. And so we need to focus more of our training on that area where there's more weakness. So we combine what's defined in the policy with what we see as sort of knowledge gaps in awareness of what employees should be doing and sort of what the threat landscape looks like. We build training out from there. And things have changed a little bit. You know, as you can imagine, we're doing a lot more remote training and we're not really doing in-person training until the threat clears. But the remote resources available now are fabulous. You know, you've got streaming video that's HD. You can have a person on a camera as well as a slideshow happening at the same time. The quality of audio is crisp and clear. There's not a lot of distortion or buffering or other kinds of issues. So you can almost have the same level of experience as in person doing remote training. And also because they're going to be in their environment, we can make recommendations that are specific that they can actually start to kind of get a sense of because they're sitting there at their computer and saying, oh, yeah. Yeah, okay, I'm able to relate to that more than if I was in a classroom setting. So we're also starting to see some benefits to doing remote training versus having everyone, you know, in the same place at the same time, but without maybe their company and its resources available to them at that time. But what we try to do in our training as our primary strategy is make sure we try our best to address those knowledge gaps, provide a Q&A period so that folks can ask any questions about anything they may not understand. And then later, when we're afforded the opportunity, we like to come back and just do a quick test. Say, okay, we've trained on X, Y, and Z. How aware are you of those core subjects? And if we find that there's serious gaps in there, we might come back and kind of do a little bit of light training again. And we recommend doing training and policy updates and vulnerability assessments, kind of everything there with, at least on an annual basis. In a lot of regulated industries, that's the bare minimum to do it at that sort of frequency.
Okay, excellent. Now, I'm going to kind of use these two terms synonymously, and forgive me if I am, but okay, I'm going to be using the word risk assessment and audit together because I have written on a number of times in my blogs that the mentality and thinking among CISOs and CIOs was that, okay, the more technology you have, the better, meaning throw everything in, including kitchen sink, at protecting your line, at beefing up your lines of defense. But now these companies are starting to realize, hey, you know, my IT security stack cannot keep up with all these alerts coming from so many different, you know, vendor packages. You know, everybody's just getting overwhelmed with it now. So I think the CIO and the CISO is now starting to realize, okay, let's do a risk assessment or risk audit. Let's see where we are most at risk. And maybe instead of deploying 10 firewalls, we'll just do two, but make sure that they're at the most strategic location so we can make things not only more efficient, but we can maybe get a bigger, you know, security budget, you know, once we show that we have a positive ROI. So what are your thoughts on that, on this security audit, risk assessment, if the two can be used together? You know, what are the next steps and how does that process play out for your client? I mean, how do you determine these vulnerabilities for your client when you're on site with them?
That's a good question, and I think on the first part of what you're talking about there, in terms of simplification, we've kind of been thrown into a world where it's a little harder to do that because everything is so fragmented now. So, you know, you used to be able to say, hey, if everyone's in the office in D.C., we can put them behind, you know, a corporate firewall, maybe a Palo Alto. We can, you know, put in a strong firewall rule set. We can have intrusion prevention. We can have monitoring. We can have some real-time mitigation strategies in place if we suspect there's an attack to automatically block those attackers. But now that everyone's, or largely a lot of folks are working from home, it's a lot different and it's a lot harder because, you know, just as an example, I've got a friend out in Texas and he works from home a lot. And he had a cable company issued a cable modem router. They kind of take both roles. And what we were able to find out when we just kind of were doing some testing on his system is that that cable modem actually had a hard-coded backdoor password in it so that their cable IT folks could come in and patch firmware and things like that. Now, obviously, that's like a worst practice because there's so many better ways to be able to automate that. But we're seeing that kind of attack surface more and more. And even in major vendors, we've seen it in Cisco, we've seen it in Juniper, we've seen it in other kinds of routers and firewalls where there's these sort of backdoors of one variant or another that are built in. And I, you know, we don't know what the intent was behind it, so we're not going to assume the worst, but we have to at least assume that that's a possibility. So quantifying risk in those types of situations becomes a little bit more complex, but it also means we just need to be a little more attentive what the chatter is out there in the hacker community, what the vulnerabilities are that are being disclosed. In terms of protecting people now, one of the things that we look at is if your home network is more permeable and you're handling sensitive data, you should probably have a commercial firewall. And it doesn't have to be something that costs, you know, five figures. It can be something that's high three or low four figures that can do a much better job than off-the-shelf hardware. You know, if you're in a situation where you're getting your internet delivered over DOCSIS where it's on a coaxial cable, you might still have to have your cable modem. But often is the case you can set it to bridge mode. So it's not doing network address translation. It doesn't have an IP listening. And that becomes a responsibility of your commercial-grade firewall. So that's one thing that we recommend a lot of clients that are working from home. It does complicate monitoring a little bit, but it also improves posture and reduces attack surface. In terms of vulnerability assessment, I think it's really, really, really important. It's probably more important now than ever before for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that because people are working from home and their networks and systems are more permeable, we don't have a lot of awareness of that attack surface. Often is the case that people's home networks have never been audited. And while we don't necessarily need to come in and do a ultra comprehensive audit, at least coming from the outside in, looking at a port scan, looking at anything available remotely, and then also looking at their system and their network, what the patch levels are, you know, how strong their passwords are, if any internal services are available that could exfiltrate data, trying to batten down the hatches there is a really good practice to get into. In terms of, you know, looking at how companies can try to kind of engage in that process but not have it be too overwhelming for them, I think that's where a third party really comes into play. Because often is the case that even if you do have the personnel, you want those personnel to do things that are either going to be billable, so they're creating a revenue stream for the company, or is that they're just kind of doing the hands-on day-to-day stuff. Once you start assigning those bigger projects to the same people that are responsible for maintaining the infrastructure, sometimes you can get, and it's no fault of their own, because they're dealing with this stuff every day, but you can get a little bit of myopia, you can get a little bit of blindness. That is to say, if you know, John set this router up, he might not look at it as if it's just like a completely new thing. He might not give it the same level of attention, and it's not his fault because he set it up. He thinks he did a great job. He probably did, but it also makes him a little bit less aware and a little bit less maybe willing to give it the level of scrutiny that it needs. And then also, you know, you look at varying skill sets. So as much as there's a sort of misnomer that if someone knows about computers, they know everything about technology, the truth is that there's so much specialization in technology. So you might have someone that's very strong in IT, but they're not very strong in security. So it's important also to have that kind of, you know, third-party set of eyes on resources and doing security audits, because you can get a different perspective and usually a more complete sense of what's vulnerable by having someone else look at that and kind of give it the level of scrutiny that it needs and the recommendations that can help with that.
Okay, excellent. Now, How often do you recommend clients to do this risk assessment audit? I'm of the thinking at minimum twice a year, semi-annually, should be done quarterly, perhaps?
I recommend that clients do it at least once a year. That's really our baseline. But in a lot of industries, it's quarterly that's going to be where you're going to gain the most benefit. And I realize that often is the case, the opinion on cyber spend is that it's a sunk cost. And I think that's something that everyone in the cybersecurity industry, including us, we have the sort of responsibility to shift that thinking 180 degrees and say, wait a minute, it's not a sunk cost. It's actually an investment that pays dividends in stability, in reduced attack surface, in reduced risk and liability. Now, once you start to be able to show that, and you know, with the whole idea that 4 out of 5 attacks don't happen with best practices being employed by a company, and you see how many companies that don't employ those best practices that get hit over and over again, they might lose customers because of reputational risk. They may even go out of business because of the financial and legal liabilities they incur. So there's a powerful set of motivations to be doing this, but I will say from a customer-to-customer basis, we kind of look at what the customer is doing, what kind of data they're handling, how they might be exposed to risk, and we make a recommendation for frequency and also depth of audit based on that. And so what I mean is, you know, in some situations, companies are already employing some pretty good policies for, say, clean desk and making sure the whiteboard doesn't have passwords or trade secrets on it when they leave for the day. In other situations, we might walk into the office and without even really doing a security audit, just with a quick glance around, we might notice they're not using secure locks. They have their passwords sticky-noted to their screens. So we kind of get a sense of the posture of the company and their level of awareness and best practices just through those kind of first stages of engagement and try to make a recommendation based on that and then also the other kind of responsibilities that they have to adhere to and risks they might be subjected to.
Okay, excellent. Now, talking about, you know, the cybersecurity spending, what's a reasonable amount to allocate? I mean, how do you educate your clients about this, and what's your take on cybersecurity spending?
That's a great question, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, is there an optimal amount? I mean, I know CISOs and CIOs that keep complaining they don't have enough money, you know, from what I read in the headlines from their, you know, board of directors. So what are your thoughts on this whole thing?
That's a great question. And the first thing that I would say is that the more budget that we have for cybersecurity, as long as it's spent thoughtfully and as long as it's invested constructively, the better the posture of the company will be. Now, obviously, there's a law of diminishing returns, but I'm thinking usually between about 2 to 3% of total revenue is a reasonable investment to look at cybersecurity. Now, obviously, that's going to vary a little bit from industry to industry. It's going to vary a little bit to, you know, what their risks are, what their posture is. But typically, having a cybersecurity budget that affords you a little bit more than you might need is important. And one of the reasons for that, and this is something you can repeat in every industry, with every business size, with every type of client, is that it's always going to cost more to respond than it is to mitigate risk. You know, and this has been true all the way back to 1999 when we first started. We always like to say that, you know, a proactive approach is a lot more sensible than a reactive approach. You can't claw back your data once it's been breached. You can't gain back the client's trust very easily once it's been eroded by, you know, this being in the headlines or otherwise being disclosed in a letter saying, hey, you know, your data was breached. We're really sorry about that. So we always like to say it's an investment. It pays in dividends. You know, trying to shift the posture away from thinking it's a sunk cost. Because often is the case that when companies look at their cybersecurity spend, they're looking at it as, okay, well, we're pretty much, you know, this isn't really like anything more than just an expense that we have to just put out there and try to make sure it's the lowest expense possible with the highest return possible. But with cybersecurity, there's a sweet spot. And that is to say, if you're spending enough that you're doing policy checks and updates, you're doing your training, you're doing your vulnerability management, You have someone kind of helping periodically. You have monitoring. You have alerts. You have a system in place to respond to incidents. You're going to be ahead of the game. If you're not doing one or all of those things, chances are you're behind, and you might be facing risks that are much higher than what your budget for cybersecurity is over the course of several years.
Okay. Now, suppose a client calls and say, hey, Alex, I've been hit with a ransomware attack. You know, they get hacked, obviously, and they need help from you. What are steps that you take to try to help them and to mitigate that risk? And for that matter, what kinds of incidents have you seen that have come on the rise? And do you even recommend a client to pay a ransomware, pay like the Bitcoin, whatever they want? Or like, what are your thoughts on all that?
Ransomware is a big problem right now, and it's got our attention because we are seeing a change in tactics. And so one of the things that we're seeing with ransomware that's really changed is it used to target individuals most of the time because, you know, if you lose your family photos, even though on the black market that doesn't have a lot of value or any at all, to you, it's priceless, so you're more willing to fork over the funds and, you know, go through all the sort of process involved with sending someone some Bitcoin or whatever the ransom might be in. But now we're starting to see it pivot and target businesses much more. And this is something that really picked up in late 2018 through 2019 in the first quarter of this year. And so we're seeing ransomware that has larger ransoms, that's more sophisticated. It's usually multi-phasic in its attack, so it can try to compromise as much as possible. So instead of just your drive, it might compromise everything attached to your computer, including cloud resources. It might compromise your backups. Another thing we're seeing with ransomware is that it's now starting to exfiltrate data. So it's not just holding your data for ransom. It actually might be taking your trade secrets, exfiltrating them so they can sell it in the black market where they do have value, or maybe your account information or your billing or your payroll or anything else. So the first thing that we try to do with a client that's been hit by ransomware is analyze the ransomware. Get a sense of, okay, what variant of ransomware is this? What is it doing? Have there been reverse engineering attempts that are successful so that we kind of get a better sense of everything it's up to? Does the client have an actual backup? And so, you know, sometimes people think if I just, you know, kind of have a sync, that's a backup. And it's not, because it'll sync the ransomware to your backup and then the backup's encrypted too and you can't get your data back. Or that backup might be impacted by the ransomware. So having a sort of air-gapped backup that's encrypted in transit and at rest, but with encryption that you control, and that's somewhere that won't be impacted by a ransomware. It's sort of like a one-way backup. It's not going to allow the computer to go in and kind of re-encrypt it. And a lot of backup providers, to their credit, even have ransomware detection. So if they detect global file changes that have happened, they'll say, hey, we're not going to back up this data because it looks like it's probably been hit, and send you a warning. And also having retention. So that, like, let's say, you know, you had ransomware hit and you didn't notice for a while for some reason, maybe it only hit a certain part of the data, you can go back days, weeks, months, sometimes even years, pull those files back. Now, if none of that's in place, we're in a more difficult position because the company is now without some important data. And depending on where that ransomware hit, like if it hit their main server, which sadly does happen sometimes, then they might be in a really bad spot. The good news is that when we're doing our sort of careful analysis of the ransomware, we're taking a sample, we're trying to figure out what it is, what it does, how it does it. We've seen more and more ransomware that has been reverse engineered by other parties. Maybe it's because they get busted and the government authorities actually go in, pull the master key, make it available to the public. Other times, maybe they used weaker encryption, so there's a way to brute force it. But we're seeing more and more that when we pop a sample in for analysis, we get back a tool that can decrypt it. So the first thing we try to do, if they don't have a backup of that data and it's important they need it back, is to see if there's a way around having to pay a bad actor. Because I can tell you, when you pay the ransom, there's no guarantee you're getting anything back. And if you do get something back, if you're lucky enough to get something back, sometimes the data is not given to you in a usable format. An example. So we had a situation where, you know, the client didn't have a backup and they had a ransomware they were hit with that didn't have a decryption tool available. And so they made the decision to pay the ransom. And when they got the data back, all the file names were mangled. The data, the directory structure, the hierarchy of folders was mangled. So it took them months to try to reconstitute that data set into something that was usable. And at the end of the day, they were kind of reluctantly admitting that with a lot of the data, it would have been actually easier to just replicate it, like rebuild it from scratch. So I always caution clients away from paying for the ransom wherever we can, because we're funding the bad guys. You know, it's just like when you get a spam email and you click the link and you engage it. The reason they do it is because people do that. The reason that spam continues is because it works. There's a segment of people that engage it. And the same thing is true of ransomware. The reason it works is because there's not a good backup, and there's desperation, and there's some impulsivity, and people just pay the ransom and they hope for the best. And, you know, sometimes they get the worst out of it. So that's sort of our initial phase, is we try to quantify the risk, what's happened, why it's happened, how we can try to get the data back. The second phase is removal of any active components of that ransomware, trying to make sure any memory resident components, any file system resident components are removed. We haven't seen ransomware that's sophisticated enough yet that it gets into firmware, which is good, because that would make it much bigger of a problem, like if it got into the Intel management engine or BIOS or otherwise hard drive firmware. But we try to then get the ransomware off, and then we try to make sure we have better protection in place so it can't happen again. So a lot of the times, you know, there's endpoint protection, which is a good start, you know, and not to discount it. But once something's on your computer, now you have to trust that the signatures or heuristic detection or engine of whatever you're using for endpoint protection is sophisticated enough, up-to-date enough, and robust enough to be able to block this. Much better if it doesn't get to your computer in the first place. So we try to take other measures to mitigate that risk, you know, combinations of things like DNS blacklisting, intrusion prevention, having a more robust analysis of network traffic, you know, to make sure that the risk of infection is lower. And then we also, you know, we always like to hammer home, and we used to do a lot of data recovery as well, so we've seen this in so many different ways, backup, and I want to see clients have at least one form of local backup that's air-gapped, at least one form of cloud backup that's encrypted and air-gapped, and I want to see clients testing those backups. You don't have a backup unless you can restore from it, and you don't know if you can restore from it unless you're testing it periodically. So we like to make sure that there's a good, robust policy for restoring data so that, you know, if there's a next time with ransomware, and while we certainly hope there isn't, it's always possible, that there is a procedure in place to say, okay, A, probably didn't get as far as it did last time, and B, we know where our data is, and we can get it back. And the other thing that's really important there is policy. It kind of all comes back to the policy and a bit to training and sort of the posture of IT resources and IT themselves, because a lot of the ransomware risk can be mitigated by making sure that employees don't click the link in that email, don't open the attachment, don't go to that suspicious website, don't click an ad, you know, that could lead you somewhere that's suspicious as well. So having that security posture defined in writing and trained and implemented in IT in terms of how they execute their responsibilities is also equally important to mitigate risk.
Okay. Well, now let's kind of get to a different area here, is the resurging of threats, vulnerabilities, and how you analyze that. Now, many of the cybersecurity companies and the guests I've interviewed, they really don't offer this kind of service, so I still think it's kind of a growing area. And can you expand more on that? How does your company Investment do that? And do you make use of artificial intelligence to kind of help you with this research?
So with regards to research, one of the things that we're really focused on is looking at what's going on in the wild. And we feel like we get a more objective view that way because we're able to kind of put something out, a public IP address, emulate a vulnerable system, and get slammed with attacks. And I mean, I can't emphasize enough just how dangerous it is to have an unprotected system connected to the internet. When you're monitoring traffic on a public IP address, you're typically getting hits multiple times a second, which means if you have a vulnerable system attached to a public IP address in any way, shape, or form, you're probably going to be compromised within minutes. And that's kind of just how bad it is with the number of threats that are knocking on the door on a regular basis. So what we do is we take advantage of that because most of these attacks are automated. And so the automated attacks are going to inject their payload whether or not you're an actual vulnerable system, because they don't know better. So we mimic vulnerable systems. We have what are called honeypots deployed on internet-facing IP addresses, and we take in those attacks and we dissect them. And I will say that AI is coming a long way, but one of the biggest shortcomings of it that we see is that we're trying to emulate the human brain in a lot of these capacities, but we don't really understand the human brain. We don't have enough clarity to really be able to emulate it well with code. So while AI is definitely growing more sophisticated, and it definitely meets the criteria of the A or artificial, we often find that the I or the intelligence is a little bit lacking. So we do like algorithmic automation in the sense of, let's look at heuristics, let's look at signatures, let's look at patterns in code to try to get a sense of, what is it doing, what's the payload actually impacting, what is it targeting, and how is it targeting that to try to inject its exploit, and then once it has, how does it operate? Is it trying to exfiltrate data? Is it trying to encrypt data? Is it trying to set up a remote access point that can be used to launch subsequent attacks? Or is it some multiphasic attack that's a combination of some or all of those? And then we also like to look at where is the attack originating from. So sometimes when you open up and kind of start to scrutinize either in a hex editor or disassembling this code, you might see references to different languages, and that can give you a clue of regionality. Often is the case that there's some level of residual clue within that. A lot of the times, especially if it's not from a sophisticated government, there's footprints, and they can give you clues as to where these attacks are originating from. So we like to look at that, too, to get a sense. You might see some Korean in there if it's from North Korea. You might see some Russian in there if it's from one of their crime groups, or sometimes less savvy parts of their government, although sadly they are getting much more sophisticated. You might see some Chinese in there if it's from some of their crime groups or some of the less sophisticated elements of their government, but they're also getting much more sophisticated. So we look at it from multiple angles. And we really try to focus, once we get a sense that, hey, this might be a zero day, those are the types of payloads we pay the most attention to, because we feel that, A, they're the biggest risk because it hasn't been something that's widely known and patched, and B, it provides the greatest value to the public safety, the public good, for us to go out there and spend some time and resources looking at those, because we can warn vendors, they can put out patches, and we can provide a warning to clients that is specific enough for them to mitigate the risk, but not specific enough for information to leak that might be useful to the hacker community.
Okay, excellent. I'm actually, Alexander, I think I may have told you, I'm running a rather comprehensive, in-depth book about artificial intelligence, and you're right. The human brain, we will never, ever be able to mimic it or even come close to what it's like. My dad was actually a professor of neurobiology at Purdue, and he was actually involved in spinal cord regeneration research. And and when I was at Purdue, when I was in high school growing up, we had some interesting talks about the brain. And he goes, nobody will really ever understand it. It's just so complex. And with AI, we're probably just at not even at 0.5% of it really understanding what the human brain is. It's just, it's not an interaction of chemicals that people say. It's not, the neurons, perceptrons, and synapses. That there's just so much more. We'll never really understand it. And I just want to point out to the audience, who have heard about AI. It's obviously a big buzzword in cyber right now. It will be for a while. But AI is really nothing but garbage in, garbage out. And really, there's nothing fancy about the algorithms. It's just all high-level statistical computations using sophisticated statistical algorithms. That's all it is, really. And a lot of your garbage in, garbage out, especially garbage outs, can be dependent upon those data sets that you feed into it. So there's really nothing mystical about it. I just want to point that out to people out there. If they think, I'm using AI, this is so magical, there's nothing magical about it. It's just a bunch of statistics put together. So
I'd love to tag along on that and just also say, I 100% agree with what you're saying. And I will even go so far as to say that I think we're in kind of an AI hype bubble right now. There's kind of like in the .com era, if you had a .com in your name, you're going to get a bid on your private or public shares. If you have some reference to AI now, all of a sudden people are piling in to buy your stock, and it's like, let's slow this down a little bit. We're not quite there yet. And like you said, we might not ever get there. But one of the biggest things that we see is it's a black box. You know, there's not a lot of understanding or documentation about how a lot of this AI works. And so when something does happen, often is the case we don't even know why it happened.
Right. We'll never get there. We'll never get there. But anyway, let's focus the next part of the show. We're interested in some of the issues in cyber, some of the more macro issues, if you don't mind. One of the big topics is the lack of cyber workers or a severe shortage of skilled labor. Now, this kind of is a double-edged sword because, you know, there's a lot of people out there who have, you know, they're coming out of college, they've been through boot camps, this, that. They have the skills, but they just need further training in the company for their jobs that they want to apply for. But at the same time, these companies don't want to waste time training these younger people or people who don't have all the experience. They only want to keep the seasoned professionals. But the seasoned professionals are getting completely burned out and saying, screw it, you know, they want to quit. It's kind of like a three-way circus here. So what are your thoughts on that, and how do you engage in fulfilling this labor shortage? I mean, do you do freelancing opportunities when you get the opportunity? Can you elaborate more on that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. It's an issue of our time in tech as a whole because, you know, cybersecurity as an industry is growing at a compound growth rate of about 17%. Now, this is pre-COVID-19 era data, but I'm imagining because the industry is still kind of firing on most of its cylinders that it hasn't compressed by too much. And certainly with the risks going up, even with economic activity going down, there's still a growing need for cybersecurity professionals. So we might have sort of like a pause in terms of what businesses are doing to invest in having their own cybersecurity people either on staff or by contract just because they're uncertain of what their future looks like. But at the same time, that's a very ephemeral moment. What's happening is a big existential issue. And it comes down to, like you said, you've got sort of on the later end of the spectrum, you know, this is just as an aside, this is a really difficult industry. It can be very demoralizing. There's a lot of folks that deal with, you know, different levels of stress and anxiety and imposter syndrome and depression and feeling like their you know, recommendations aren't being taken seriously or that it's just never going to end. The nightmare just keeps escalating. So, you know, I can very much relate to burnout. I'm not there. I love what I do. I think security is such a fascinating component of technology that I don't think I'll ever tire of it. But I've met a lot of people that have, and I completely empathize with the reasons that they have. On the other side of it, you know, you've got folks that are fresh out of college. They'd love to get into this. And companies are certainly always wanting to hire someone they can pay less salary to. But then if they look at the onboarding process of, oh, well, we've got to train them. We've got to get them continuing education. They're not going to be ready the moment we hire them. They might be less willing to take them on. We also see that create the sort of niche opportunity that more independent professionals that are contractors or freelancing or otherwise running their own organizations are having more opportunities to be sort of that outsourced virtual CISO. I think in the longer term, this is going to have to be addressed by changing education fundamentally. And so if you look at a country like Estonia, they start teaching their kids how to code in the single digits of age. They start teaching robotics. They start teaching, you know, other elements of computer science. And so they have a very tech-savvy population. You've got a lot of very smart, very talented people. And, I, you know, part of it might be regionality, but a big part of it is education. We don't do that here. You know, and back when I was going to school, computers weren't even really used much outside of things like Logo or maybe playing Oregon Trail. But, you know, you didn't really learn code. And even now, you know, when I talk to parents that have kids enrolled in school of various ages, it's either not existent or it's deprioritized or it's overly simplistic. And we're supposed to be this great leader of innovation. We're supposed to be in this country sort of the leader in technology and in inventing new types of technologies and so forth. But at the same time, we don't have a population that's ready out of college most of the time to really be able to take the responsibilities and have the wherewithal from a knowledge perspective to do a good job. And we also don't have a lot of interest in it because, you know, there's just not enough exposure. So while I feel fortunate that I got that Commodore 64 and it kind of put me on this course, I feel a little disappointed that that tact isn't the default, that like as soon as a kid can talk, as soon as they are learning, you know, like in basically kindergarten or first grade, they should be given a computer. They should be given hands-on instruction on how that they are going to use that computer. Technology is never going away. It's going to be a bigger and bigger part of our life every day, every month, every year that goes on. So I think the biggest thing that we need to emphasize as a country is education in technology at the earliest age possible across the board, A, so that we can have a higher skilled workforce, which is just better for everyone. It's better for their socioeconomic outcomes. It's better for the security of our country. It's better for how we can maintain our competitive advantage as to one of the, you know, the most robust economy in the world for now. If we want to keep that, we have to keep reinvesting. The other part of it is, you know, I would just ask companies to look at hiring someone new with a different set of priorities. And that is to say, you know, sure, they're young. Maybe they're a bit inexperienced. But at the same time, you know, if you plan to have your company for the next couple of decades, then recruiting and investing in a younger workforce actually makes a lot of sense. You know, you can have someone that you bring on, that you mentor, that you kind of mold and shape into the exact type of employee that is going to be best for their career and best for your company. So I feel like it's multiphasic. I feel like it has to start with education, but, you know, we're not going to fix that right away. We might not fix that at, you know, anytime soon. So we need to also be more understanding that the newer entrants in the workforce, they're assets. We need to invest in them. And also, you know, with what's going on with sort of, you know, I think 30 plus million people unemployed on a conservative assessment of unemployment, we also need to start looking at these kind of New Deal programs where instead of, you know, just saying, okay, well, you're out of luck, here's some unemployment and some stimulus and we hope the best. You know, we need to start saying, okay, how can we skill you up? You are in another industry that maybe doesn't exist or isn't doing so well. How can we take that and make it so that you have an opportunity moving forward in the future? And just a quick example, in West Virginia, you know, there was a giant coal industry. And a lot of that's, you know, dying off. And for the environment, that's a great thing. But for the jobs that were there, it's a terrible thing. And so what I've seen is some tech companies going out to more rural areas where there's a lot of unemployed and seeing an opportunity to take these people, train them how to code, give them an entry-level job, continue that education, and they're able to pivot from a career that, quite frankly, was dangerous to their own health and the planet to a career where they feel like, hey, I'm contributing in a positive way, I'm learning new skills, and most importantly, I have employment and I can contribute to the economy. So I would say that we need to take a different approach as a society from, you know, the earliest of ages all the way through to where we are now. There are so many brilliant people who have a lot to offer, and they just need some help getting them to the point where they'll be a valuable resource in this industry.
Okay, excellent. Now, another issue in cyber is that of cybersecurity risk insurance policies. A lot of companies, I mean, a lot of these big carriers are now offering this, and then SMB, you know, they'll think, oh, I've got this policy, I'm not protected, but more than likely, they may not be completely financially protected when they file a claim. Now, has your company ever done any work with cyber insurance policies? Have you helped with clients in that regard?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's a really important point that you bring up. So a couple things that I want to address there. First is, I think that every company should consider cybersecurity insurance. Doesn't mean every company needs to get it, but everyone should consider it as a part of their cyber spend. If you're in a regulated industry or if you face very high legal and financial liabilities, I think it's a must. And in some situations, there's regulation or engagement letters that say, you know, you absolutely have to have it. In terms of picking a cybersecurity insurance policy, it's really, this is a new era. I mean, it's existed for a little while, but it's still very new to insurers. They're still trying to calibrate their pricing, you know, what the deductibles are, what the premiums are, what they actually cover. So you'll see a lot of variability depending on who you engage. I think the first step is to try to work with an insurance company that has more expertise and devotion, that this isn't just a small component of their offerings, that it's one of their primary offerings. Second thing is to make sure that your insurance agent is someone that you have a good relationship with, that has good rapport, that has expertise, where they're not going to just try to sell you a policy to make a commission, but they're going to try to sell you a policy that fits what your company needs. And I know no one wants to sit down and read 20 or 100 pages of policy. It's not the most exciting thing to read. There's better things to spend our time doing. At the same time, if we're not aware of what that policy actually covers, if we're not aware of what the exemptions are, then we might not have insurance at all, even though we think we do and we're paying a premium for it. A couple of examples. First is, we see in a lot of these policies that there's a minimum level of diligence required. You have to be doing things for your security. You can't just buy cybersecurity insurance, do nothing, get hacked, and have it cover everything. They're going to say, whoa, you kind of opened yourself up to this. We're going to step back and exempt ourselves because we're going to cite this clause that says you didn't do the bare minimum. Another thing that we see with these cybersecurity insurance policies is often is the case that the deductible is extremely high. So you might not be covered unless the cost of the incident is over $50,000. Now, if you're a small enough business, you know, going up to $50,000 could be a business-ending event. And since the premiums tend to be quite high, you need to be mindful of that, you know, sort of how you define that risk. Are you just going to set cash aside, have a good law firm on retainer, and make sure you invest in your cybersecurity so you mitigate that risk, which is really kind of necessary anyway if you're going to get policy, or you're going to add policy on top of that. So my two cents on it is every company should consider it, but it's not always appropriate for every company, and pay attention to the fine details.
Okay. Now, finally, as we wrap up our show, Alexander, let me say the best question for last, the $60,000 one. What is your laundry list that you tell – well, let me put it this way. Obviously, we all are prone to cyber attack. You know, there's no such thing as a 100% protection. What do you tell clients, SMBs, even individuals, your friends, family? What can they do to protect themselves from mitigating the risk of becoming a victim of cyber attack?
Absolutely. And that certainly is a big question, and it's an important question. I think for businesses, for governments, for organizations, it all starts with a foundation of a comprehensive policy, one that's up to date, that's crafted for your industry, for any of the regulatory scrutiny, engagement letter responsibilities, and kinds of data that are being handled, one that's updated regularly as well, and then trained on so that people know exactly what's expected of them. They can adhere to those responsibilities and try to make sure that when they're doing their sort of day-to-day routines, such as patching servers, changing passwords, managing antivirus software, looking at the firewall, making sure that it's managed appropriately, that all those are adhering to the policy or exceeding the expectations set forth by the policy. I also highly, highly recommend that every business takes their network perimeter seriously. We talked about how hacking attacks are, you know, happening every couple seconds on internet-facing IP addresses, if not multiple times a second. That network perimeter needs to be guarded. You know, you can kind of consider it like the front door to your house. If you don't have it locked, let alone have a deadbolt, then anyone can come in and go into your network and exfiltrate data and start attacking other networks and resources or hold your data for ransom or any of these other sort of nightmare scenarios. Protecting internal resources is also of crucial importance. So every computer, every server should have some kind of protection. Endpoint protection is important. Also having a DNS blacklist, so when they're querying something that's known to be a malicious website, that it's blocked before it even has access to their computer is important. Having a blocker in their browser, like an ad blocker, that also allows them to subscribe to similar malware lists of known bad actors, so it's blocked before it's rendered in the browser, is another layer of security that can be added on top of that DNS blacklist. Having management of systems is really important, monitoring management. You know, right now people are working from home a lot more. But if you have a good remote monitoring and management system, you can mitigate that risk. You can have almost the same level of awareness as if they were on premises, because you can have alerts like a suspected malware attack, update couldn't install, corrupted operating system issue, other types of issues. Maybe the firewall won't start up. That can sometimes be a symptom of malware, or at the very least something that needs to be addressed because of the attack surface it exposes. So always important to have monitoring and management in place. I recommend minimalism. And so what I mean by that is embrace the idea of trying to use the smallest set of applications that you can. You know, often is the case you look at a phone or a computer and there's all sorts of stuff installed that no one's using. And if we're paying attention to the sort of news flow that was happening with Zoom over the last month or so, you know, I will say I like Zoom overall for conferencing in the sense of its functionality is great, but the security posture was very poor. So we had password exfiltration attacks. We had attacks on Zoom where, you know, someone could maybe access your webcam or your microphone. We had attacks where, and this was kind of built-in desired functionality by Zoom, where they know what's running on your computer, what's on your main screen, even when Zoom wasn't engaged for a conference. Now, they've battened down a lot of that attack surface to their credit, but there's a lot of apps that we're all probably running that haven't, whether it's on our phone, which is kind of like the nexus of all of our information. You've got banking apps on there. You've got access to corporate email or other kinds of data on there. So there's a lot of apps that probably shouldn't be on there. Some of them might even be malicious, clones of other apps. So minimalism is a really important thing to embrace in terms of what you're relying on, so it's much easier to maintain. We also recommend looking at sort of the broader framework of cybersecurity as something that's ever evolving. So, you know, don't sit on your hands and become complacent. Once you've got a strategy in place, reevaluate it periodically, whether it's every quarter or every year. Make sure that that strategy is consistently looked at to make sure that it reconciles with what the reality, what the threat landscape is out there. And I think one of the most important points is bring in an independent third party. Don't just, you know, kind of feel complacent that you've taken some steps and that everything's going to be okay. Have an independent third party come in, audit, remediate, engage for consulting to try to make sure that there's an ongoing basis of best practices being adhered to, update policy, train on that policy, just kind of basically make sure there's a set of eyes that's not embedded in the day-to-day that can help to quantify where the weaknesses are and how they can be addressed.
Okay. Well, Alexander, this really has been an enlightening show. I think probably one of the key takeaways for SMBs, and especially in today's COVID-19 environment, is the need for security planning, to have that plan in place and to really rehearse it to make sure that next time, hopefully this will never ever happen again, but as you said, it probably will at some point in time, that they can act quickly and get that workforce out there quickly and not have so many issues as we're having right now. So, once again, thanks for your time, Alexander, and have a great rest of the day and the weekend.
Robbie, thank you so much for inviting me on as a guest. I really appreciate it. It was a great discussion, and I wish you the same. I also want to say that I hope that everyone's listening and yourself as well stays safe and stays healthy throughout the rest of this crisis.
We will. And you too and your family. Take care.
Thank you, Robbie. You too. Bye-bye.